You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.
And today I wanted to speak to the representative for the Bahamas contingent. And today we have Dr. Nambi Hall Campbell and the chairpersons of the Reparations Commission of Bahamas. And she is online with us. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning again. Thank you for having me. So my name is Dr. Nambi Hall Campbell Dean. I am the chair of the Bahamas National Reparations Committee, a position that I've held since 2021. And that's my side job. my day job is as a professor at the University of the Bahamas in the psychology department. And so really, we took up the mantle of reparations in 2013 when the CARICOM Reparations Commission was first founded and the Bahamas Reparations Committee was formed then under the CARICOM Reparations Commission. And so we're just really excited about this resolution that was passed on Wednesday, because it really gives us an opportunity not just the opportunity, but it gives momentum to the movement that we've been engaged in for over a decade now.
And also, I'd like to also welcome Mr. Shabaka Kambon to the conversation as well. Good morning to you. And I kind of understand how you are feeling, because you've also been an advocate for quite some time for the space of African peoples and the African story. What does that mean for you?
Well, we are celebrating, you know. First of all, we are both Dr. Campbell Dean and myself relieved that our country's standing on the right side of history on this one. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps more so myself, being Trinidadian, noting some of the recent actions of our own leadership. But we're happy, of course, and of course we're happy that we can imagine, the way that this would have resounded with our ancestors. So there's a deeper feeling of connection to this decision, this historic decision as well.
Also waiting for Dr. Fergus to join us as well from the Freedom Project to tell us how he's feeling on it as well. But Dr. Campbell Dean, I want to go back to you and the statement from Bahamas. The next question would be, well, first of all, let's start at the very start of it. What does reparations mean? What does it look like? And how that definition steps into the conversation as it applies to what the countries who have been part in history, taken part in this, how do we approach them with the word reparations?
Sure. So reparations, very simply, means to repair, right? Means to repair a damage that you have caused, you were the perpetrator of. And so in the reparations movement, in CARICOM, in the Caribbean, we employ a developmental model of reparations, meaning that we're not necessarily asking for former enslavers or colonists to write out checks and hand them to each person in the respective countries, but that we have a 10-point plan, a model of development, areas that were underdeveloped in the wake of colonization that we feel reparations can really speak to. So things like education, help with the public health crisis. The 10-point plan is under revision and the new one is coming out. And so it will include things like, I think the caller that was just on talking about restitution, reclaiming goods that were stolen, repatriation, debt cancellation. So all of these things come under our 10-point plan model of reparations. And this is the way that we see reparations falling out in the region. And so this this resolution is really instrumental in saying you were the perpetrator of this crime and that this was the gravest crime against humanity. And so there are no statute of limitations for crimes against humanity. So there's a really strong movement for reparations.
And Mr. Cambon, how does Trinidad and Tobago play in this part? I know with the Freedom Project, there have been acknowledgements in terms of like the removal of monuments to colonizers and colonial systems. What do we do next?
Okay, so I'm glad that you raised that question. First, let's congratulate the Ghanaians, led by Brother John Mahama, for the role that they've played, walking in the footsteps of the great Kwame Nkrumah, who, of course, was inspired by Caribbean people, Marcus Garvey among them, and who was also guided by Trinidadian brother George Padmore, and who brought him in as the Minister of African Affairs when he took over leadership of one of the first independent countries in Africa. So we want to acknowledge that history and to celebrate Brother Mahama for what he's done. We also want to acknowledge that this is, Naomi already spoke about the role that this plays in the reparations movement. Mm-hmm. We also want to acknowledge the role it plays in removing the barriers that prevent people of African descent from exercising their rights and realizing their potential. And of course, they are quoting the Secretary General of the United Nations. So I think those are the two areas where this is going to play an important role. And so I think there's something else I must have mentioned. This builds on the development from 2001, the Durban Declaration. And there we want to also celebrate Caribbean people. We're thinking about people like Ambassador David Comisjong and my own father, Kafra Cambon, who would have gone to Durban and pursued an ambitious agenda to have slavery declared and the transatlantic slave trade declared a crime against humanity. So this goes one step further. So from 2001 to 2026, where it's now understood to be the gravest crime against humanity. The United Nations, the highest decision-making body in the world, the collection of nations has agreed that this is not just a crime against humanity, but the gravest crime against humanity. And now we want to contrast that now with what is in our textbooks and our public spaces. Mm-hmm. So when that declaration is made now, it shines a light. It contrasts sharply with what your children, your nieces and nephews, what not Dr. Naomi Hall Campbell's nieces and nephews and children, my children are being taught at schools. The way that history is being, that period of history, that important 500-year or 380-something years of chattel slavery is being taught to children. The gravest crime, again, none of them could go to school right now in the Caribbean and get an impression that they're actually talking about, first, a crime against humanity, and even, let's say, the gravest crime against humanity. Whereas they could just pick up any book on the Holocaust and get the impression that it is the gravest crime against the humanity, for example, just to give a contrast. And that's now also reflected in our public spaces. So what we learn in our textbooks in the Caribbean tends to be reflected in our public spaces. Our casual, acceptance of colonial symbols, statues and the like that were established during that period of this grave crime against humanity, the gravest. Those that celebrate the people that perpetrated these crimes are still with us today. And of course, if we were educated differently, we would notice that. We would feel uncomfortable with it. We would change it. As it would be easier to make those transitions. But the challenge we are having is that, and I think we're going to get a boost from this thing, that the people will now realize what we have been advocating for, in the case of the Caribbean Freedom Project since 2016, and what we've been quite successful at in a number of areas, but we still have a lot to go. So, for example, from 2016, we removed the name of Alfred Milner from the University of West Indies.
Yeah.
We ended the celebration of Count Lopino, the slave master, and his wife, as illustrious, and the huge the ridicule of our ancestors as loyal slaves at the only plantation that was established as a point of reference for education in Trinidad and Tobago. We removed Columbus's monuments, two statues from Port of Spain and from South Trinidad, and we got rid of his three ships from our coat of arms. In the Bahamas, an activist, right here in the Bahamas, an activist in Nassau, removed Christopher Columbus and put the government in a strange position where they have him, they have the pieces of him, but they don't know whether they're going to put him back or not. So both countries have advanced to some extent, but the whole Caribbean is dealing with these issues. And places like Puerto Rico, the Dom Rep, and so on, they've been calling and asking how they could benefit from the advances we've made in Trinidad and Tobago, and how they could join the places like the Bahamas that no longer have a Columbus monument, a statue celebrating Columbus in the heart of their administrative capital and so on. So there's a lot of work to be done, and this resolution really is going to impact, gives us an opportunity to look at the education system, both in the classroom and in the public spaces, and also at the continuation of the persistent barriers that prevent people of African descent from exercising all their rights and realizing their potential.
So my next question would be to the both of y'all. The countries that have resolved not to accept this resolution, Argentina, Israel, and the United States making a comment to the point that it doesn't make sense being quote unquote punished for something that was considered lawful during that time. How do we approach systems and countries with that type of mindset, especially in the current international relations that we see right now, where as the term neocolonialism is being bandied about, how do we create these spaces for correct information, correct education, as stated before, and still have that sense of cooperation amongst countries that have decided not to go with the resolution? Dr. Campbell-Dean, you can go first.
Sure. So I think that one of the things that we have to note when we're looking at the countries that said no is that they have very vested interest in not believing in this resolution and not paying reparations, right? So I think that one of the main ways that we attack these types of positions is with the truth. And that's why this resolution is so important. When the United States said that this slavery was legal at the time, one of the things that has to be noted, and Ambassador Thomas Song does a really excellent job on this, I think he even has a book about it, is that slavery was actually illegal at the time, right? That there were laws in England that stated that you could not enslave another human being. And so what did they do? They created laws to state that people of African descent weren't actually quite human, right? So that's where we see the three-fifths of the person come in. That's where we see the chattel aspect of the transatlantic slave trade come in, right? So while they're trying to use the law to say, oh no, we're on the right side of history, we actually know that the law was circumvented and then crazy, heinous things were put in place to say, well, you're not actually human, right? So we can make this law to work against you, to suit their needs, to suit their profits and their agendas. So we have to consistently understand what the truth is, know what the truth is, and just meet these assertions at that point of truthfulness and honesty. And I think that will be the main way that we can address it.
Mr. Cambon?
Well, I read Ambassador. Well, let me endorse what Dr. Nyambi just stated very clearly there. It's not just Brother Kamis Yong, but of course the world has affirmed these things. And I've read Ambassador Dan Negrea's statements very carefully, and I want to add another aspect of his statement that is so controversial. You know, he talked about, right coming down to the end of his speech, he talks about the trafficking of African slaves. He says that it began long before the 15th century and sadly continued even after the 19th. These dates were clearly selected for political reasons rather than historical accuracy. All trafficking of enslaved Africans and racialized chattel enslavement of Africans deserves to be condemned, not merely the political expedient. I think this is this speech, when you look at the way that this speech is constructed, you see that it's deliberately constructed in such a way to obscure the truth and to obscure the facts. That's why I think if you read the resolution carefully, you'll understand that they're speaking specifically about racialized chattel slavery. And that's a very distinct project to the other types of enslavement that have taken place from the beginning of time. You know, and the resolution went to great lengths to define what that project was and what made, racialized chattel slavery, which is what we're talking about here in the Caribbean, the use of Africans, including the dehumanization of Africans, the robbery of the culture and names, the kinds of innovations in brutality and violence that took place in that project, the systematic way that project was carried out, the way that European nations who implemented it organized themselves completely and entirely to loot other nations starting in the 15th century. And then not just to loot other nations, but to loot, to make that aspect of it fundamental to this looting, and the duration of it and so on. So these are the things that went into this particular resolution that some of those who don't want to accept it try to pretend that racialized chattel slavery is the same as slavery in the rest of the world, the same as slavery that would have taken place in Africa and India, etc. This is a completely and entirely different project, far more violent, far worse than the other aspects of slavery. The other thing that comes across when you look at the ambassador of the United States, his speech, he says that he refers to Donald Trump's support for the African American community, what he calls the Black community in the U.S., and he says we reject suggestions. Indeed, President Trump has done more for Black Americans than any other president and enjoyed historic support from the Black community. And he's working around the clock to deliver for them and make our country greater than ever. This statement flies in the face of what President John Mahama, Ghana's leader, said in his speech on the 25th, where he openly criticized the United States of America under this current leadership for the way that it is attacking African Americans and in particular African-American history, and even more specifically the history of slavery or enslavement of our ancestors, right? The work that they're doing to remove exhibits from museums, to change textbooks, to outlaw and ban the teaching of this particular period of history. So he explicitly exposed those things in the United Nations. And so we could see the kind of the delusional nature of the current American regime in the rhetoric of their ambassador, the unwillingness to address the ongoing crimes against African Americans from this particular leadership, this regime in the United States of America. Very, very unfortunate situation.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we can talk to the Barbados Prime Minister Mia Mottley actually putting a price for her country in terms of how she sees reparations and the continued movement to at least get the public aware that this is ongoing discussion. And I'm sure that many people aren't aware of it. And speaking of that, you can call us at 625-2257, 627-3223, and of course 306-1065 to send in your messages to get in on the discussion and to find out what your definition of reparations, what does it mean to you? We'll be right back. Welcome back. And if you're just joining us, I have Mr. Shabaka Cambon and our special guest, all the way from the Bahamas via Zoom, Dr. Yes. Nyambi Hall Campbell Dean. And we're talking about the resolution that was made on the 25th of this month that has designated slavery, chattel slavery, as the gravest crime against humanity. And that does put significance on the discussion on reparations and the way in which we as countries that have been colonized and looking for reparations, what that would look like. We have some calls coming in. Let's take some opinions from our listeners. 625-2257, 627-3223. Hello, good morning. Hello, good morning.
And a pleasant good morning to you there.
Good morning.
To your guest there. They're live. Well, I think I heard they say one on Zoom.
Yes, Dr. Yeah, Campbell Dean is fire soon.
When I call and I ask her going on, so I know we're going on this morning.
I appreciate it, Fast Track. I appreciate it.
I want you to pick the idea there and the advertise on the website of the company.
Uh-huh.
I say, what? I can't give any the kudos on the radio. Mm. They feel too nice. I might blush and bite all the mic.
Yeah, no, Fast Track, ask your question.
Yeah, right. You know, I, as far as I look at it, right, you know, history have some unpleasant chapters. But you know, I'll ask the people that talk about reparations, right?
Mm-hmm.
What let us work out a system other than what happened, because was the slave cells that held their own counterparts to gather on the boat to come to be captured. They themselves held themselves for the captors. And hand them over to be carried on at the end of the day. I don't think, to be honest with you, I kinda glad well my ancestry from the Afro is on my mother's side and my father's side is from Venezuela. So I kinda glad we end up down here, you know, because I think I want to go back in another country, Trinidad is the happiest country in the world to live in. And I think I want to go back and, you know, those of us that kinda you trying to rewrite history, digest how it was, and that it was in those days. They were purpose. They came here to do the plantation and the kind of populate the place, and digest what it was. How, other than that, what was the? I would have liked anybody who talking reparation. How give me another work out another system that you would have liked to see happen, and present it to me, and from there we could further the discussion.
Thanks
so
much.
But as far as digest how it is, but history does have unpleasant chapter, and that was an unpleasant chapter, but. You know, in life, one does always suffer for one to enjoy, and you know? That is just how the life trend, that is how, just how the physical life trend is, you know? You may work hard, like, that things that I didn't have and my children could enjoy. That is just how it is, that things your grandparents didn't have and I had. So that is just how life transit. Have a blessed one, bye.
Thank you, Fast Track. So let's look at that particular statement that Fast Track did make, which we've heard many times when we begin to talk about slavery and we talk about reparations. It happened so long ago. And some of the places that we were quote-unquote taken from aren't any better than where we are now, which is a misconception in itself, Fast Track, if you really look into some of these places. But Dr. Dean, go ahead and tell us your perspective on that, and Mr. Cambon, you can come in after.
So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective, you know, and I think that it's one that's kind of rooted in this Caribbean sense of, well, you know, you make the most of it and you keep going. But if someone was to come into your house, steal everything out of your house, steal your children, rape your wife, and then make you go back into that house and work it for free, wouldn't you have a problem with that? Wouldn't you feel like, you know, well, some justice needs to be done around this? Wouldn't you feel like maybe that wasn't right? So if a crime is wrong in the moment that is committed, it was wrong if it was committed 10 years ago, 40 years ago, 400 years ago. Wrong is wrong and it has to be accounted for. And the thing that this resolution sets up so beautifully is not only that that was that wrong at the time that it happened, but that that wrong that happened and persisted for 300 years has impacted every level of our society and every systemic structure that we see in the Western world. Politics, economics, development, religion, education. There is no system and virtually no country in the Western world that has not been touched by this gravest crime against humanity. And so we cannot just say, oh, that happened in the past and move forward, because our forward is being impended by what happened in the past. And so we have to recognize it, make amends for it, and move forward knowing that justice has been awarded, right? So that's the first thing. I think the other thing that I want to note is that oftentimes when we talk about the transatlantic slave trade, we say, oh, well, the African sold y'all, so what y'all mad for? You know, y'all people did, we did it to ourselves. But one of the things that I always point out when this statement is made is if Africans were so intrinsically a part of this trade, how come when you go to the coast of West Africa and you go to the communities where these torture chambers, now called slave castles, are located, how come you don't see the massive development? Where is all the wealth that they would have gotten from selling their own people into slavery? If they benefited so much, how come they don't have grand structures and developed cities like Liverpool, right? Like Glasgow? Because you can clearly see the wealth that slavery enriched in these European countries. It's not there in the African countries, because the Africans did not benefit from the transatlantic chattel slavery, right? And you also have to understand that the transatlantic chattel slavery was a slavery that was developed to turn people into chattel. No such system existed on the continent of Africa. So when they said, oh, we'll trade, they were trading the people that were already enslaved, thinking that, okay, you know, you will treat our enslaved people the way that we treat them. That wasn't the case. So these are the things that we always have to keep in mind when we talk about this chattel slavery. And this is why the point that Sabako was making earlier, that education about what this crime actually was, is so, so important.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Campbell, Dr. Nyambi, for making that, to clarifying those issues. I wouldn't go there. I want to go straight to Fast Track himself. I think, you know, the former colonial masters would be very proud, because the real success of a settler colonial project is in convincing the native that this project exists to benefit them, that they turn around and love the perpetrators of the project. And the project itself, they see it as something to love and to appreciate. That's the true success of a settler colonial project. And your colleague Fastrack, you know, reflects the penetration of the what we would call epistemic violence of the project. You know, because colonialism and the Prime Minister and President of Ghana, John Mahama, he touched on it in his speech, the way that, you know, that violence transcends the physical realm and enters into the mental and psychological realm. He mentioned Bob Marley's notion of mental slavery. And in his speech, he talks about the way that what is the substance of mental slavery? It really is the imbibing in, according to John Mahama, the imbibing of the violence and erasure. And here we're not talking about physical violence. Again, we're talking about the epistemic violence, violence enacted on or through knowledge. And erasure is part of that. So what you see happening in the United States right now, in their attempts to turn slavery from one of the gravest crimes against humanity into a unpaid internship, where workers were brought from the continent of Africa just not paid.
But we haven't used terms like that, so it kind of resonates as well, because there are unpaid internships currently for our young people when they come out of universities or colleges and so on. I had slightly to interrupt here. We've got a call coming in. Let's take it. Hello, good morning. Hello, good morning. All right, we lost that one. But to quickly reference what reparations look like in terms of our Prime Minister Mia Mottley from Barbados, she said that Barbados is owed $4.9 billion in reparatory damages by slave-owning countries. Prime Minister Mia Mottley said as she called for global conversation on payment of debt for colonial slavery. Ms. Mottley praised King Charles during her lecture at the London School of Economics for his comments that the time has come to acknowledge the impact of slavery while on a trip to Rwanda last year. We're not expecting that the reparatory damages will be paid in a year or two or five, because the extraction of wealth and the damages took place over centuries. But we are demanding that we be seen and that we are heard, she said on Wednesday. Ms. Mottley had a meeting with new British Foreign Minister David Cameron while she was in London, but said she would not disclose the details when asked if Barbados asked him about the UK making reparation payments. She had previously cited an estimate of $24 billion based on a standard definition of damages. And from the perspective of the Caribbean, I always tend to look at Haiti and the countries like Haiti, in that they continue to pay damages to a colonial system, I believe it is France, for losses of the demolition of slavery. And it baffles that in this current time that there are still conversations like that. Can we put that into perspective, speaking on what reparations really mean and what it would look like moving forward to the Caribbean diaspora? Mr. Yes, Campbell? Yeah.
Right. Well, first of all, yes, we want to acknowledge that Haiti, starting in 1825, paid a form of compensation to the French colonists of 150 million francs you know, reduced to 90 million. I think it was legally 150 million francs, and that was being paid up until 1947. So our parents were alive when Haiti was still paying for freeing itself. And that made Haiti, you know, it brought Haiti into what the overall emancipation project of Europe, which was one which stated that the slave masters had to be compensated for their loss of us, which we call freedom, the loss of us in property, in chattel. And so so all the emancipation projects of the Europe, there was some attempt, I think perhaps in most cases successfully, to compensate not the people who were enslaved, but those who, in their words, were losing property. And so once Haiti had freed itself, France decided to use gunboat diplomacy to force Haiti to do what other people had done. And remember, in our case, the British government continued to pay those, that compensation, up to 2015. I don't think people realize this, but if your uncle and aunt had traveled to live in the UK, when they paid their taxes, they would have been participated in the repaying of that debt. And of course, our ancestors themselves paid part of that debt. Dr. Hilary Beckles and Maureen Shepherd point out, through the apprenticeship system, what we call the apprenticeship system, after the end of the official end of slavery, that period in our case, I think it was 6 years. That was a period of free labor that was to add another amount on top of what the British state was going to pay from their own treasury, so that there would be, a significant compensation to the enslaved. So that's part of the Emancipation Project. And all of that is being taken into consideration in this historic resolution. This is why we talk about the impact of all of that, the apartheid that followed slavery in the Americas. We think of when we talk about the injustice of our people under in colonialism, we have to remember that the colonial project continued after enslavement, and therefore the colonial violence continued. And we have more and more, we're using the term apartheid to describe those kind of Jim Crow conditions that existed post-emancipation, right up to independence, right up to the 1960s in the United States of America, the civil rights and black power movement in the United States of America. And so all across the board, we're talking about a lengthy period of violence that starts with the genocide of the indigenous people of the Americas and results in a society today that is hierarchical, that has a caste system in which African people are embedded at the bottom and disadvantaged in all kinds of structural ways because of that embedded into the in at the bottom, not just in the diaspora, but in terms on the continent, internally on the continent, and between Europe and countries in the continent of Africa in the global economic sphere. So an entire system and structure of disadvantage has been created. And that's what makes this particular crime is now considered the gravest crime against humanity. Very, very important development. Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, sorry, I was muted earlier. But yeah, I don't think that there's too much to add to that. This is the reality. These are the facts that, you know, we have been paying for this crime since it was inflicted upon us. And reparations is really a movement of justice to say we're no longer willing to pay, and we're no longer willing to to sit in the underdevelopment that was left in the wake of the crime of enslavement, but also the crimes that were perpetrated in colonization, like the truck system that you just outlined. And so I have to go at this moment, but I do want to just say thank you so much for giving us this outlet to talk about this most mm-hmm. important resolution. You know, the time, there's a Caribbean poet, Alexis Pauline Gums, and she states in one of her poems that what they wanted was everything. What they wanted was everything. And so I think that this is really our moment to take everything back. And we have to educate ourselves and understand what these resolutions are. And hopefully we'll have more opportunities to share this information with the masses mm-hmm. In the future as we move forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us as well. And I see that you would be making a presentation for the people of African descent next month in Geneva. Would most of what we've said be part of that presentation to the Geneva audience?
Yes, absolutely. Just continuing the fight for reparations, outlining why it's important and why we can't let the mantle go until we see it.
Thank you once again for joining us.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.